Welcome to Podcast by the Bay, Josh. It's been since May of 2019. It was the last opportunity to interview you. A couple things had changed. You were in the primary running for the Senate. I was not an elected official, too. But before we go on, I probably might not see you on April 13th, your birthday, born in Pennsylvania. And happy birthday. And we also share the same month. I'm April 6th. So I guess we're kindred spirits in some way, Aries. We have an opportunity here, and I'm going to give you a little background about Senator Josh Becker. Senator Josh Becker graduated from Stanford University and College of Williams College. During the time Stanford student, he confounded a program called Stanford Board Fellows, which trained students to serve in local nonprofit organizations and in social progress. He graduated from the university with a JD and an MBA degree in 1999. There's something unique, Josh, that I'm going to kind of give you a heads up on. I'm a little trivia nut on American history, but it seems to come into play into your life, too. First of all, we talked about April 13th, okay? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me how many, this is a pop-up quiz, how many stripes on the American flag?
Well, I thought you were going that it was Thomas Jefferson's birthday. But is it 13? Is it 13?
13 is correct. 13 is correct. Now, how many original colonies?
12.
Well, you're off by one. 13.
Now, that was a trick. I thought it was a trick question.
Well, no trick questions. And what is the 13th Amendment?
I should know that. I do know. I should know this, but I can't. It's escaping me. It's Sunday morning, you know.
Oh, it's the elimination of slavery.
Okay, that's right. Got it.
Well, anyway, I want to welcome you. You represent the 13th Senate district in this area. This is representative of you and representative of the Bay Area, representing Silicon Valley, including hubs of Stanford University and Sand Hill Road. As a member of the legislature, Josh is the author of several bills focused on accelerating California's transition to 100% clean energy and zero emissions. He is the vice chair of the Joint Committees on Climate Change Policies and chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Clean Energy in the Future. His other community memberships include Business, Professions, and Economic Development Committee and the Energy, Utilities, and Communications Committee and the Transportation Committee. Prior to being elected to the California legislature, Josh was recognized through Clean Energy Through Leaders. He helped spearhead efforts to solve the clean energy business and advocate for the founder of Clean Energy for Obama and the Clean Economy Network. As a founder of New Cycle Capital, Josh was a seed investor in the companies that such as OPower, Renew Financial People, One Book of Grid, TerraPast. Josh also founded the Coast Circle in 2000, a community leadership and policy innovation organization that funds nonprofits.
Full Circle Fund. I think you mean Full Circle Fund.
Full Circle Funds. As a JD MBA from Stanford, Josh was a longtime board member of Clean Energy Open. He was appointed by Governor Jerry Brown to the California Work Development Board and founding a trustee of the University of California at Merced Foundation Board of Trustees, where he served as chair from 2013 to 2015. Welcome to Podcast by the Bay. We've only got a few questions. We know we appreciate your time. I noticed I was reading in the paper of a new bill on Senate 119, which is encryption legislation. Could you explain to the audience what you're trying to legislate there? I know I did talk to a few other elected officials and they wanted to, and voters, that they wanted a little bit more clarity on what you're looking to accomplish with passage of 719 Senate bill.
Sure. Well, for 80 years, the media has had access to the police radio scanners. And they use that access to be able to alert the public to basically to know what to cover themselves, to know what's going on, to understand and be able to alert the public and inform the public. And as I mentioned, that's happened for 80 years. Now, at the same time, what's happened in recent years, people wanted to protect personal identifiable information from going out on those police scanners. And that's obviously very reasonable. That's a good public good. But what happened is a number of police departments kind of use this as an excuse. And the Department of Justice in California, unfortunately, gave out some very, confusing guidance. And so some police departments use this as an opportunity to fully encrypt all communications. And that was not what the Department of Justice was saying. The Department of Justice was saying you have to protect personal identifiable information, but there are lots of ways to do that. You can actually do that and provide access to the public and to the media, the police scanner access they've had for 80 years. So the CHP, for example, figured out a way to do that. Palo Alto was one of the first cities to actually go to the fully encrypt, and the newspapers were justifiably very concerned about this. And actually, Palo Alto reversed itself and said, yeah, you're right, we can do both. We can protect people's personally identifiable information, and we can still provide the media access that it's had for the last 80 years. And so that's really all that we're doing with this bill, just saying that, yes, you can do both, and you should do both. You should protect our personally identifiable information, and you should give access to the media so that we can keep track and they can inform the public and keep the public safe in terms of knowing what's going on in the community. The Monterey Park shooting, for example, the police didn't get the information out for 5 hours, even though the killer was actually on the loose for part of that time. And so we don't want to be dependent, especially now, I think, after George Floyd and everything. We don't want to be dependent on police departments to release information when and if they see fit. We want that information available, particularly to the media, so they can track it and keep the public aware of what's happening.
Thanks, Senator. You're quite aware and very passionate about sea level rise. Can you comment on one bayfront? I did an interview with Len Matterman, and actually it's quite a unique thing that he has put together on. Why don't you comment on what current legislation you see coming forward or that you're going to be pushing on sea level rise?
Yeah, I think one shoreline with Len Matterman. I was with Len just the other day looking at the Pacific, we're touring Pacifica and looking at the needs of the coast in terms of, in terms of sea level rise in the coast. But as you know, San Mateo County is actually among the most at risk in the state from sea level rise. And we need to do both things. We need to be working to prevent the worst effects of climate change. And obviously I'm doing that with my legislation that we can talk about. But we also have to prepare for the sea level rise that we know is already going to come. And I now chair the budget subcommittee that is responsible for all the money for natural resources, for water, for climate. And that also includes a sea level rise. And the governor stripped out almost 40 to 50% of the money in the budget for coastal resilience. And so we're fighting now to put that money back into the budget, knowing that it's very critical. So there's lots that we're doing now to say, hey, we have to prepare.
All right. Well, thanks for your answer. You know, California has somewhat, maybe a little over 30% of homeless in representation of the United States. As of 2022, the people of the United States experienced homeless residents in California, including of all unsheltered people, is 115,491 in California, which really almost represents 50% of the United States. Do you have any comment on I know there's a lot of legislation coming forward. I know our governor is pretty aggressive on the homelessness. Any of your input that you feel that is necessary now and back there in Sacramento to conquer or try to solve this problem of homelessness all over the state?
Absolutely. You know, we've put a man on the moon. We can solve homelessness. of a bill. I don't want to scoop myself. I don't know when this is going to be released, but of a major piece of legislation I'm working on for this year. Because what we've seen is there are scalable solutions. You know, Life Moves built a within 6 months, modular construction, 100 units, 120 families, 1 acre, third of it is supportive services. If the governor came out, I texted the governor, said, we need to do more of these. He said, yeah, we need to do dozens more of these. And that's really what my legislation will be focused on. How can we scale up this kind of housing, take advantage of public land as well as private land as well, but have the codes in place so that this is quality housing that people may want to stay with a year. What we're finding is people want to stay longer. Even people who have gotten placements into permanent housing say, no, I actually want to be back in here because there's more of a community. So there's great potential to scale up very quickly. And we've seen a nonprofit called Dignity Moves within 2 to 4 months be able to get substantial amounts of housing in Rona Park, in Alameda, in Santa Barbara. And we're looking to scale that kind of a project up very quickly. And so that's something I'm very excited about and you'll be hearing more about soon.
Okay. Can you comment? Our San Mateo County won an award for the homelessness on its creativeness on how to solve the homeless issue. I think they've established over a couple, almost a little over 1,000 units by taking over some hotels. And they're trying to call that, and my hat's off to our county manager, Mike Calgary, for doing such an outstanding job. Can you comment a little bit about what do you think of the way that San Mateo County is dealing with the homelessness? Because I think it is a pioneering way of approaching it.
Yeah, Mike Calgary has done a tremendous job. San Mateo County has a roadmap to get to zero, and that is the aspiration. And I think that's the kind of goal and single-mindedness that we need. They did take over a number of hotels, which was through a state program called Home Key. So we have to give credit to the state and to the governor and the administration for launching the Home Key program, Jason Elliott and all the folks involved there. And now there's also this navigation center that's being built in Redwood City. So San Mateo County has really stepped up with its ambition, with its focus, working with Life Moves to provide supportive services, really proud of the work that the county is doing. So the goal is to get to functional zero for homelessness. That doesn't mean there won't be a single homeless person, but it means if someone's homeless, we have a plan, we address it, and get them into a shelter and then onto permanent housing.
Okay, great. You know, this dovetails into another issue that we're dealing with predominantly with the homeless is mental health. San Francisco had some creative ideas, but maybe not so creative ideas on how to address the homelessness. I think to some people, it was almost taking homeless people's rights away and taking them basically almost arresting them, so to speak, or trying to rehabilitate them in some fashion. How are we dealing with mental health in this state right now? Is there any good new legislation that you feel that is coming forward that is possibly going to help eliminate some of that? Because obviously, if we solve some of the mental health issues, maybe we can solve much more of the homeless issue.
Well, mental health is a massive issue across the state in a bunch of ways. I mean, I did a town hall on youth mental health that people really appreciated. Our youth were struggling. We kept our schools closed. I'd argue closed too long. But we know that took a tremendous mental health toll and exasperated some things that were already going on in the community. And so there's a whole youth mental health piece, and we have some legislation, and we put $2.5 billion into youth mental health, trying to get more counselors in. We need more adults in schools, period, but getting more counselors available and more resources on high school campuses, on even middle school campuses. So that's one piece of mental health a crisis. Another is a mental health workforce. So we've had, as you know, many of the jobs don't tend to pay too much. And then people going into debt to get these master's degrees. So we have scholarships now available and a real focus on funding the mental health workforce to try to get more people into the mental health professions, as well as to raise wages. So there's a lot of aspects to it. And as regards to the homeless as well, or homeless specifically, estimates are between 20 and 40% of the homeless population has severe mental illness. This is between 15 and 20, 25,000 people. And that's one of the goals of Care Court. This is the governor's program to say, okay, great. How can we get a treatment plan? And as you know, maybe right now, even for your child, if you have a child over a certain age, the parents are helpless. They can't do anything. And so Care Court is really to be that process to say, okay, let's develop a care plan. And LA has started a year early to implement Care Court, and we'll start here in our area probably in a year from now. But that's one of the promising things. But there's a lot of work to be done here. And, you know, this goes back to the LPS legislation, as you know, in the 70s, and the closing of some of the hospitals. We had over-institutionalization for sure, but then we potentially overcorrected and got a situation where the courts have interpreted the definition of severely grave and disabled very, very narrowly. Susan Eggman, who's a compassionate social worker, has a bill to expand that definition to include people who can't take care of their own health needs. And it was killed by one person who happened to chair the judiciary in the assembly last year, but that bill will be back. So yeah, we have a lot of mental health legislation specifically around, as I mentioned, in that area, specifically around the mental health workforce, and then schools and youth as well.
Well, in San Mateo County, they're kind of pioneering a program with a specific number. As we know, most police departments are overwhelmed by 911 calls. Mm-hmm. Do you see that legislation of more that one phone number that people can call somewhat of a counselor or social worker? Are you pretty familiar with the program? And maybe you can explain to the audience how it works.
I'm not as familiar with what San Mateo County is doing specifically in that area. But from what you said, yeah, I mean, having a one-stop shop place where people can call for people who are having mental health episodes, get people who are trained, not having the police immediately respond, as we've seen, has been highly problematic in other parts of the country as well. So that's what I imagine it is, but I'll follow up with the team there and talk about
it. Okay, that would be great. As of this date, 2023, there's been 26 mass shootings, six of which are in the state of California. What's your take on that situation? And is there some words of wisdom or legislation that could help taper this? It kind of dovetails into some of the mental health issues that we just talked about.
Yeah, I think nationally the number is much bigger, actually, even in mass shootings this year. It's really quite extraordinary. And then we had a shooting in my district in Half Moon Bay, incredibly tragic. And so, yeah, I've been very involved in legislation. It's there's areas where California can lead the country and really lead the world, like in climate legislation. But in guns, as you know, we are hamstrung by federal laws, but there's many things that we still can do. And despite some of the shootings, including Monterey Park and Half Moon Bay, on average, California has many fewer people die from gun violence than other states who don't have some of the laws that we have. So we're continually working to say, okay, what can we do to keep guns out of the hands of people who are mentally ill, who have other red flag situations where domestic violence or other things? How can we ban assault weapons, weapons of war that can kill people so quickly? What can we do around safe storage and all these things? So there's a lot that California has done, but there's a lot more that we're working on. I'll be holding a joint town hall. I reached out to Assemblyman Mark Berman, who I know cares a lot about this as well. I said, why don't we do a joint town hall? So we'll be doing a joint town hall on this in April.
Okay, I'm going to give you one more question in this direction, then we're going to go into some energy questions here. Recently, the governor is rethinking or changing the San Quentin, especially death row situation, and trying to turn it into a more of a rehabilitation and a second chance opportunity for people that have been incarcerated for years. What's your thoughts on what the governor is doing on this?
Yeah, I think it's tremendous. We've reduced our prison population substantially, and so we're looking at all kinds of now innovative approaches. And because at the end of the day, in any prison situation, most people are going to get released at some point. And so the question is, what can you do to make sure we have successful reentry, that they become productive members of society? And what the governor is looking at there is looking at things that have worked in Scandinavia, in other countries, now starting to take hold in other parts of the U.S. as well. I know Chester, Pennsylvania, near where I grew up, is one of them that was mentioned in the LA Times article. And so I'm really supportive of these efforts. I think it's very exciting. You know, San Quentin is a place where we already have a lot of programming. The GRIP program, I was at the graduation for GRIP, Guiding Rage into Power, fantastic year-long program of accountability, people writing letters to victims, really taking a pledge not to use violence again, but a pledge in this very deep emotional context of this year-long exploration that they're doing. So lots of things have been in the prisons with Defy Ventures, where we teach entrepreneurship. We actually did the first ever business plan competition inside a state prison. So we're seeing lots of innovative ideas here to make sure that people that when they do get out, they can be connected with their families. I had a whole bill called the Keep Families Connected Act. One of the first in the country to say, hey, we should have pre-prison phone calls. We want to keep people connected with their social networks. We want to keep people connected with their families. All the stats show that helps successful reentry. So these are all things that we're looking at. And I've not been through all the governor's proposals in San Quentin. This is relatively recent, but I'm excited about the direction.
Thank you. One of the major problems in this country, or at least in this state, and it's probably across the United States, is electricity, PG&E and gas. And I want to specifically deal with the state of California. We're currently experiencing rapid increases in electrical bills and gas bills. And I know you're interested in clean energy. I'm not asking you to predict the future here, but it seems that we need some new technology here, and that maybe the PG&E is not going to be able to sustain our electrical grid. So I was wondering if you had any comment on that. I'm not trying to corner you about PG&E, but I want you to kind of express, what do you think is the futuristic opportunity for electricity and gas? Or do we... some of our constituents, meaning homeowners and real estate agents and brokers and a lot of passionate people, are passionate about clean energy, but we're also passionate about the cost factor, because obviously converting to electricity from fossil fuel is going to be quite expensive. So maybe you can kind of comment on, where do you think PG&E is going to go, and where do you think energy should go?
Well, PG&E has all kinds of issues. We've seen power outages. We've seen fires caused. We've seen gas lines where they blew up and killed people in San Bruno. So there's all kinds of issues with the PG&E infrastructure, and we could spend several hours just on that. And in my position now, with both my on the Energy Committee as well, but in my Budget Committee, a lot of my focus is on holding PG&E accountable, making sure we make the investments, or make sure our infrastructure is more 2023 rather than 1923, as it seems sometimes, with the outages that we've had, that I've had personally. We've had a whole forum in East Palo Alto where schools were closed many days. We've had schools here in Menlo Park closed many days just recently. So there's just all kinds of issues. And, you know, we've seen the monopoly, the limitations of the monopoly situation here that we have. So my predecessor, Jerry Hill, worked very hard on this. They put in a procedure in place. If PG&E makes a couple more mistakes, the state can take it over. And I'm certainly supportive of exploring that. In the meantime, there's a lot of things to be done. Number one, grid reliability, as you mentioned. And this is a priority. As we've seen, adding solar energy is great. And we have lots of solar during the day. It's the cheapest thing to build. And wind energy. We really have to adjust the peak. That's really the 4 to 9 p.m. That's where we're still burning lots of fossil fuels. And that's where things like geothermal and ultimately offshore wind, which is a big focus of mine, offshore wind is non-correlated with solar and non-correlated with offshore, with onshore wind. So it actually starts really coming on board in that 4 to 9 p.m. So that's going to be a major investment. I was touring, I've toured offshore wind in other places around the world. We will have the first floating offshore wind here in the U.S., but I toured floating offshore wind in Portugal. And we ultimately think we have 20 to 30 gigawatts of energy, but obviously that needs new transmission. I had a bill on transmission last year. I'll have another bill on transmission this year. So we need to make the grid more reliable. Secondly, PG&E interconnection. What I mean by that, if somebody does want to upgrade their home, I tried this in a bill, SB 68, my first year. Now I have another bill on interconnection. So we have to hold PG&E accountable for saying when people do want to upgrade or when new infrastructure is built up, they have to on time do their job and plug it into the grid, which has been a huge issue. And then third, in terms of electrifying homes, that's, I think, you know, people are seeing they want to do that for safety reasons, for other reasons. I electrified my home here in terms of a hot water heater and a heat pump. And heat pump is really a misnomer because with the heat pump, you also get air conditioning. And many places in the peninsula, including where I live, you didn't need air conditioning when we moved here 20 years ago. You know, it was maybe, you know, oppressive for 8 days a year, but you could live through that in the bedroom. And then it became 20 days a year, 30 days a year. You have a mobile unit. We had another mobile unit. But now with the heat pump, we actually have whole house air conditioning, which is tremendous. So it's really a quality of life situation as well as stopping using greenhouse gases, as well as stopping the emission of NOx and other climate pollutants, or not climate pollutants, but, you know, pollutants in the home that lower air quality. So there's a lot of things, but it's just not, just in the early days of solar, not a lot of people could afford to pay $30,000 a month upfront for solar. So the industry came through, we set the signals with policy, and then products came along where you could lease solar and no money down solar. And I worked on some of those in the early days with Clean Power Finance. And now we're starting to see the same innovation with home electrification. So I think this will be a very different conversation in a year or two. I had a bill allowing, hopefully, if the PUC interprets it correctly, to do on-bill financing via the utility bill of home electrification and other home, you know, and other electricity improvements. We have a lot of private companies that are now kind of coming into the market as well.
Maybe, Senator, you can influence a couple of my constituents, and I'm one of those constituents. Yeah. You know, you open your PG&E bill, and they have a little note in there saying you're a violator or that you're using too much energy. But after my investigation, further investigation, they don't know whether you have double pane windows or solar or how many people are really living in your home and the energy. So I think the people are a little bit upset that, you know, they want to conserve energy. They want to do the right thing. And the only thing PG&E continues to send them in an envelope is a graph saying that you're a violator. And they have no idea whether you've got solar panels, double pane windows, or whether you insulated your house. And we all realize utilities are going up. So maybe we can develop a better partnership with PG&E.
Yeah, because the other piece of that is electricity rates, too, are way out of whack here because we shove all this cost into electricity rates, all the wildfire costs, lots of other costs. Our electricity rates are way too high, and that prevents some people from electrifying their home who otherwise might because our electricity rates are just through the roof. So lots of issues there. We're also working on that one as well. But yeah, I hear you. Rather than give you a laundry list, you know, that really PG&E should say, hey, here's three things that you can do, right? And very practical. And again, I think that's where we'll see some of these startup companies.
Can we get a State of the Union town meeting with PG&E? I know I presented that at my council meeting. I would be more than cooperative to have a couple cities to see if we can get a PG&E representative to come speak, but maybe that is a pipe dream.
Well, I think that'd be great. And that's essentially what happened last Thursday with East Palo Alto. The PG&E representative came and got yelled at appropriately so for about 2.5 hours. But it, you know, I mean, it was good for, you know, at least somebody from PG&E was there to listen and hear, you know, and hear why the community was upset. And so they did it. So, yeah, I don't see why we couldn't do it in other places, too.
Well, you know, I attended the Gilead's had a green energy symposium and with all kinds of the most brilliant minds on PG&E and electricity. And it seems like that maybe we will be run by batteries a little bit more than we will be run by the wiring from a big transformer, too. Because I think the transformers have caused a lot of the fires across the state.
Yeah, that's true. We'll see more about it. We put about 2 gigawatts of batteries in just since 2020. You know, that's almost the equivalent of Diablo Canyon output, right? So we are adding a lot. So again, I think the grid is going to look very different in 5-10 years. You know, when we set a renewable portfolio standard saying, hey, we have to have a certain amount of renewable energy on the grid, we said 5%. People said that was too much. We blew through that. Then we said 15%. People said that was too much. We blew through that. Then we said 25%. We blew through that. Then we said 33%. And now we have a 60% goal by 2030. For renewables, and we're already at about 40%. So I think we're going to keep adding to the grid. But at the same time, we got to have batteries and other things for that grid reliability that we discussed earlier.
Okay, and just a couple more questions, and I'm going to let you go because I know your time is valuable. Can you comment on the Silicon Valley bank situations taken over by the Fed? I know it's a little premature at this point because they're still under investigation. It is my bank, or not my bank, but the bank I bank at with my business. So I'm wondering if you could just give us a little bit of comment and reassurance to the public out there that we're in good hands.
Well, I will say, you know, it was an old-fashioned run on the bank, right? They got lots of a lot more deposits in after 2020 when tech was sort of going up like this. They invested in treasuries, which seemed probably like a safe thing to do, but they didn't hedge that risk. And, you know, didn't anticipate interest rates going up so quickly. And then people said, well, I could buy U.S. treasuries from the Treasury Department at 4-5%. Why am I banking with you for 1-2%? And then we saw an old fashioned run on the bank. So, my concern, you know, my focus, and it was a hairy weekend. And now we keep seeing articles and articles now coming out where entrepreneurs are talking about what that was like. And maybe you experienced this as well. People couldn't make payroll on Monday. I mean, literally, if the bank, all their money was frozen. And in California, you can't legally employ people if you can't make payroll. And so were people going to have to lay everyone off on Monday? I mean, what was going to happen? It was really, that was some of the worst ripple effects that we could have seen. And so my focus, and Senator Padilla was incredibly responsive. The governor was incredibly responsive, was talking to the president directly, communicating the importance of this. And we had to give confidence that depositors would get access to their money. And not just get their money back, which they have. Depositors have always gotten their money back in every bank crisis in recent times, but that they would actually have access to their money. And the Fed's acted, and I think reasonably so. Now, you know, that was really my focus. In terms of the health of the banking sector, I think, you know, with the First Republic and Silicon Valley Bank, I think things are okay. But, there's still some, a lot of discussions going on. There's still some of these regional banks are still trying to shore up their balance sheets. So there's a lot of different pieces, you know, a lot of moving parts, shall we say, still to go. But that was really my focus, when to make sure people, all the businesses, the many, many businesses, yes, many tech, many biotech, but many other businesses as well, and nonprofits. I got, from the Four C's here in San Mateo County, which takes grants and then gives them to, home childcare businesses and such, and their money was frozen, and so that would have been a disaster. And so we kind of mitigated the worst effects, but I don't know if we're 100% out of the woods yet.
Okay, Senator, you've been there almost. You're going into your third year. I'm proud that you're there. I was there at the inception or primary, but for a moment, if you had a magic wand. And finish your term and then go on to another term. What's your wish? What are the major things that you'd like to tackle during the time that you're there serving us in the Senate?
Yeah. Well, that's what my team's doing. We just had a retreat and really looked, we said, what are the 5-10 year goals that we could, they took a big, hairy, audacious goals, that we can, that we can shoot for. And there's a number of them, certainly homelessness that we discussed earlier, you know, as I mentioned, we put people on the moon, we can solve homelessness. I mean, that is something that is a priority of mine. Climate change, leading the country. You know, I had a bill last year to have our state government be net zero by 2035. That means all our vehicles, all our fleet, all our buildings. I think we're in the middle of a major, major shift right now. And I think California can help accelerate that, both in all aspects of that, in terms of building, in terms of transportation, in terms of building materials and cement, in terms of agriculture, in terms of removing carbon from the atmosphere, which we also have to do. And so my goal is to dramatically speed that up and bring in that net zero target from 2050, 2045, and bring it much faster. In education, we got free community college in San Mateo County through my bill, as you know. And I really long-term would like to change the way we do education finance. I was in Australia. Everybody gets loans. If you get a degree and then you hit certain salary benchmarks, you pay back a certain percent of your loans every year. And so I think changing the way we do education finance to open up higher education, make it affordable for everyone, create asset building policies so that lower income folks don't go into huge debt to provide for college. So access to higher education is a big priority as well. I'd say those are three areas, others as well, but those are three big ones for me.
Well, on behalf of Podcast by the Bay, Senator Josh Becker, I want to thank you for taking the time and the opportunity to speak with us. And we encourage you to keep your doors open as you always have and your correspondence and your phone calls. We love you. Thank you very much for serving.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Always happy to. This is a great time Sunday, although, you know, I need clearly need more coffee if I couldn't answer basic constitutional amendments questions. But
well, you know, my high school students that I teach once in a while, I substitute. Most of them couldn't answer it either. So we've got
to. I should be able to. But anyway, but still, it's wonderful to be here. And, you know, always good to talk to you.
And always good to talk to you. Thanks. Thanks, Josh. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Podcast by the Bay. You can contact us by email at podcastbythebay@gmail.com. Podcast by the Bay is a production of Bay City Communications and is sponsored by Liberty Realty. Liberty Realty, serving the peninsula and surrounding areas since 1986 for all your real estate needs. www.liberty-realtyinvestments.com. All material and content is property of Podcast by the Bay, but does not necessarily reflect the views of Podcast by the Bay. You can follow us on Twitter at Podcast by the Bay as our handle, or on Facebook, facebook.com/podcastbythebay. And remember, you can listen to any of our episodes anytime on any podcast site. Until next time, stay tuned.